You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 13th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Eddie Gloud, chair of the African American Studies program at Princeton University, professor of religion, author of Democracy in Black. He's also written a piece about why he will not be voting for Hillary Clinton in Time Magazine, or Time.com, as we call it now. Also on the program today, up to you whether or not you believe him, Paul Ryan says no vote on TPP in the lame duck. Hillary Clinton yesterday in the speech with Bernie Sanders made a point of slamming the TPP. Also on the program today, Mike Pence, Newt Gingrich, Chris Christie, unnamed general. Does it matter? Well, maybe for the nature of jokes that we'll be making about it. I mean,
that is just nailed it.
I want to say the suspense is killing me, but all it is it's making me feel like we're going to have to do a lot of rushing. They don't even have a schedule yet for the Republican convention, and it's causing a mild state of panic amongst media people.
Do you have a preference?
Do I have a preference as to who?
GOP, yeah.
I just think Mike Pence would be just... It's too boring to make fun of.
Agreed.
In fact, the speech last night by Donald Trump following Mike Pence was so incoherent, even for Donald Trump. And the audience looked like they literally had just shown up at the wrong event. They looked like they belonged at that event, but they had a look on their faces like, wait, what happened? That I actually think that Trump probably walked off the stage and said that Mike Pence screwed the room for
me. It's Mike Pence's fault. I mean, he came out there. You can't look.
You know. Meanwhile, Corey Lewandowski, the newest CNN hire, still on the Trump payroll. Whoops.
Sterling Drape up, Ral.
Speaking of which, goodbye, D.B. Cooper. We hardly knew you. Joe Paterno did know about Sandusky from day one. We're going to bring that back. We'll bring that one back, says Donald Trump. And some scary polls out for you to freak out about with your friends and family. I'm not so concerned, but, you know, that's what we're going to be doing for the next...
I'm closing the gap.
3 or 4 months.
It's true.
I was looking at the polls. I'm debating about whether or not I should share this with you, because there's a lot of times where people think, oh, Sam, you... Or say to me, I should say. I don't know what they really think. You really seem to know what you're talking about a lot of times. How is that? You have such insights. And really, all I do is like 5 minutes of homework on some of this stuff that it doesn't even seem to occur to people. Even who have my job to do before they make proclamations. So here's what I would suggest, you know, when you're looking at polls and such. Go to, I think you can Google this and find it by just putting general election, McCain versus Obama. And then 2016 presidential race. You look at the Real Clear Politics aggregates polls. And you can see, like, okay, as I look at all of the polling data, were there times where John McCain was in the lead? Now, as late as September, Obama always had the lead. Some polls had him at 5. Some polls had him at 9. Some polls had him at 3. Some polls had him at 4. And if you go all the way through that, then, you know, sometime in October, there was one poll that had him as high as 11 and as low as 4 and 3 in October. And then one that had him at 14 and then back down. And you can see it's very easy to look at. McCain did not lead in any poll after October, I think it was. But if you go back down to early September, you start to see more McCain leads. one in early September, he was up by 10. That was following the convention. And then in like July, you see a couple of polls, McCain up by 4, McCain up by 1, but Obama up by 7, Obama up by 5, Obama up by 1. You can get a sense of just like, okay, this is what polling looks like for a guy who ends up winning by, 5 or 6 points. And then if you go to the Clinton v. Trump, you start to look at it, and it looks, and it's still, I don't have all of it yet. We've only just started doing just these two. Polling doesn't look dramatically different. So that's, you know, when you, the time to start freaking out is when you see a divergence. And also know that the extent that polling overall is not catching changes in demographics, know that it's, to the extent that it doesn't get changes in demographics, those changes would help the Democratic nominee. The trend is not towards more Trump voters in terms of demographics in this country, or Republican voters, broadly speaking. With that said, there are some polling, some Quinnipiac. Nevertheless, it's a swing states. But, you know, people will freak out. People won't freak out. I just want to talk about this one story because I remember this as a kid. And then we'll get to Professor Gloud. In 1971, and this came back up because of Mad Men. People were speculating maybe this would be the ending of Mad Men. There was a hijacking, and this was a fairly common, relatively speaking, common phenomenon relative today. Planes got hijacked a lot in the 60s and the 70s. A lot. Like enough like where it was not rare for people to know somebody who had been on a hijacked plane. My uncle, who actually Saul is named after, he was on a hijacked plane.
What was the hijacker in that case?
I can't remember. Just some dude. People were doing
that's
it like
really
literally.
Striking that it was like so almost relatively typical that he didn't even like tell the story so many times that
yeah,
it's like embedded
no,
in
it
your
wasn't,
brain.
No, it was
wow.
Just like I heard it offhand. Yeah, he was in a hijacking. He was scary, but it was fun. I mean, it was like literally, it was almost to the point where like people were like, I couldn't afford a ticket, so I hijacked the plane. So in 1971, there was a Seattle-bound plane. And a guy came on the plane who ID'd himself as Dan Cooper. He was dressed in a business suit and tie. He looked to be about, 45. He was got on a plane in Portland, going to Seattle. This is November 24th, 1971. So I was 5 or 6. But it was a big deal. Everybody talked about this. After takeoff, the man told one of the stewardesses that he had a bomb in his briefcase. And the plane landed in Seattle. He freed 36 passengers for $200,000 and 4 parachutes. They took the plane off with crew members aboard, and this time he said, go to Mexico City. at some time during the flight, he jumped out of the plane with parachutes in the middle of the night with the ransom money. Nobody knows if he survived it. They speculate that he jumped out somewhere between Seattle and Nevada. Nobody knows what his real name was. And for now 45 years, the FBI has been trying to figure out who that dude was. And they finally gave up yesterday. 45 years.
It totally should have ended Mad Men that way.
I mean, and so nobody knows, did the guy die like in the Sierra Nevadas or something?
Nah, he sounded like he knew what he was doing.
He
knew what the hell was going on.
He knew what the hell was going on. We're going to play a lot of sound today, folks. We got a lot of sound.
He wasn't studying math.
No.
He's a real man.
Well, I'm sure there was some math involved in that.
Yes.
But that's
not
algebra,
though.
I think that supports our contention. Math is only good for nerds or for people who are trying to commit crimes. So, we're not criminals here. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Eddie Gloud, not sure how it's going to show up on camera today, but I pre-taped this about an hour ago. All right, here we go. We'll take a quick break and then come back. We're back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program. He has been a guest on this program many times, Professor Eddie Gloud. He is a professor of religious studies at Princeton University and author. We guess we had you on in January for Democracy in Black, your latest book. Eddie, thank you for joining us to the program today.
Man, thank you for having me, as always. It's a pleasure to dialogue with you.
And I will also say there's a piece at Time.com right now that's getting a lot of attention that we will speak about as well, that we will post on the blog at majority.fm. But I first want to just get your reaction. Now, we are a week out from the viral video of Philando Castile that circulated after he was shot, basically a point-blank range, by a police officer that had pulled him over ostensibly because he matched the, the wide berth of his nose matched that of a criminal. And Alton Sterling, who was grabbed in front of a convenience store for on a report that he may have had a gun, and shot again, a point-blank range, video of that as well. And then subsequent to that, obviously, the Black Lives Matter protests across the country in Dallas, a crazed gunman chose to make that take that opportunity to shoot police officers with a high-powered rifle and killing five. He was subsequently blown up. I mean, how are you processing these things?
Well, it's been a very difficult few days, as you can imagine. So it's a combination of trauma, grief, and trying to, in some ways, make sense of the particulars. What we saw with Alton Sterling and with Philando Castile, right, is the precariousness of Black life. Brother Sam, I mean, there's a sense in which Sterling, who had been selling CDs in front of that convenience store for years, was puzzled. And it's an open carry in Castile State, right? And so there's a sense in which the way the police managed that situation and the visual representation, I mean, to actually see the scene where they have him on the ground and then suddenly shots ring out. The reason why he unholstered the gun, we don't know. It was just unsettling. And then Philando Castile, he complied according to the extraordinary coverage of Diamond Reynolds. She was, you know, he complied in every single way with what the police officer, apparently instructed him to do, and we still witnessed him bleeding out. So it's, how am I managing it? I'm trying to manage my emotions at the same time that I'm thinking about it. So one thing I see is the value gap on full display and its consequence. The consequence of the value gap for black people, Brother Sam, is that we live a precarious life. You never know when you're going to take your last breath, under what conditions or in what context. That's the first thing. And then with the murder the tragic murder of the police officers in Dallas, which is a kind of consequence, a horrific consequence of the state of the country, trying to make sense of what this means as a lone figure, as people across the country come to terms with their rage, what they will do, and then also trying to think about the rhetoric surrounding Micah Johnson, and how it becomes a kind of, or provides justification for transferring the theater of the war on terror to the domestic terrain, and what that, and how that makes me really, really concerned.
I want to just go back for a moment and remind people of your concept of the value gap, which you talked about in Democracy in Black.
Yeah, so the value gap is this, you know, we talk about the achievement gap and the wealth gap and the empathy gap, right? But the value gap is something much more fundamental, that this society is organized along the belief, right, or in light of the belief that white people matter more than others. And to the extent that that belief animates our practices, right, our cultural practices, it shapes our social and political and economic arrangements. No matter what the inputs are, the outputs will be inequality. And so if you have a group of people who are valued more than others, it means that you have another group or other groups who are valued less. And when that happens, those people, right, oftentimes live a life of precariousness. They work harder for less. Schools aren't as readily available. Jobs aren't readily available. I mean, we go down the line in terms of thinking about how that inequality manifests itself. And the value gap, Brother Sam, obtains, right, even as we progress on the racial front. So we're not the same country that we were in 1966 as we are in 2016, and nor are we the same country in 1966, were we the same country as we were in 1946 and 1866, right? And with each kind of advance, whether it's, you know, articulating the freedom, you know, the principles of freedom, liberty, and equality in the context of the American Revolution, the value gap reasserts itself by reconciling those principles with the institution of slavery. I was just reading, or Civil War, or, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, or even the election of Barack Obama. In each instance, there's an advance that is then arrested by a reassertion of the value gap. I was just reading a wonderful presidential address by Judith Sklar, the political theorist out of Harvard, and she talked about the uniqueness of the American context, that we were a modern constitutional state with slavery, which was actually unheard of, and that the reality of slavery, racial slavery, overdetermines what we mean by citizen. And America was not a democracy, she argued in that address, I think it was in 1991. She argues in that address, wasn't a democracy to the passage of the Civil War amendments. I would even extend it all the way to the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights and 1965 Voting Rights Act, precisely because race arrested democratic possibility, right? Limited democratic rule. And so that reality, right, is at the heart of the value gap. And the value gap is not about loud racists. It's about how all of us live our lives.
All right, I want to just make that point clear too, it's not the value gap does not manifest itself in the explicit words or the explicit dispositions of any individuals per se. It can. I mean, I guess, you know, there are people who come out and simply say, like, look, non-whites are inferior. But in the main, to reiterate what you're saying, in the main, it manifests itself through our choices about, I want to live near a good school. I want to live in a good neighborhood. I want to make sure my kids are hanging out with the right people. And
right.
Invariably, that ends up segregating people in some way from black people and people of color if they are white. And
yeah, and I use this analogy when I'm talking to people trying to explain racial habits and value, the value gap. I use this analogy, right? I don't believe, I'm not a climate change denier. I believe the world is getting warmer, right? And I think it's the way we're living our lives that's making it happen, right? That it's human-induced. But if you look at how I live my life, you look at my car, you look at my house, you look at my light bulbs, right? If you look at the way I live my life, you would believe, you would think that I don't believe the world is warming at all. Right. I don't. So it's not about the people who are running around screaming, that the world is okay, that the melting of the polar caps, you know, that doesn't matter. It's those people we want to read as the nutcases, right? Or we, you know, if you disagree with them, and then we absolve ourselves, right, from contributing in any sort of way. But when you look at how we live our lives, you see that we're actually contributing to the warming of the planet. And that's the way racial habits work, right? It's one thing to talk about the racist bile of some of the Trump supporters and point to them and say, see, look at all of those bad people. It's another thing to kind of point to the choices we're making in our day-to-day lives that reproduce reproduce racial inequality, that give life to the value gap. So it's not just a bad group of people. That's too melodramatic. It's all of us.
And we could say that even in the context of like a policy like property taxes funding schools.
Cool.
Where
absolutely.
Where you start with people who necessarily on, you know, day one, they were slaves in the United States. But day wherever we are, there's still going to be that gap. And we don't care. We set up the system in that way because ultimately the people who get rewarded by that system are the people with power and who are share the same complexion of the people who have power, largely speaking. So,
right,
and when you say any advances that we make, institutions come in. So, I mean, that's clear to me. Let's say post Reconstruction, you have Jim Crow laws come in. So that maintains the gap in some way. It's almost as if, like, my daughter was 7 years old on the day my son was born. They're going to be 7 years apart at all times.
Exactly.
And even if one grows a little taller, she'll come in and she'll just keep growing in that way. What are the other institutions? Like, for instance, I guess maybe as I say it, it becomes even more clear since 1965 when we had the Civil Rights Act. We see the diminishment of the Voting Rights Act. We see what other things do you perceive?
But, let's just be very clear, right? I mean, so it's not just simply, Jim Crow emerges in post-Reconstruction era, Brother Sam, but it's also convict leasing. Mm. I mean, cities like Birmingham were built on the backs of black labor conscripted by police, right? For vagrancy, I mean, ranges, so how convict labor, right, which has everything to do with how black communities were policed, right, rebuilt cities in the South in so many places, right? And then when you think about it as well, you think about, when we talk about the Great Society, right, and you talk about the legislation that came out of that period that had everything to do with the grassroots mobilizing and organizing that happened in the context of the civil rights and the black power movements, right, and the Johnson administration and all. But the last piece of great legislation that came out in 1968, the Fair Housing, I think the Great Society is the Fair Housing Act of 1968, right? 12 years later, just 12 years later, Sam, is the Reagan Revolution. He's elected in 1980.
Right.
So 12 years, what can you do to undo, generations of discrimination? What can you do to undo that in 12 years? Absolutely. And we know by 1980, there's a wholesale attack, right, on the assumptions, right, and the laws that undergird, that supported an effort to address substantively, even in a limited way, inequality. So not only do we see it in what you've described, we see in public school education, we see it in the labor market. We had a dual labor market. There's a reason why African-American unemployment is always twice that of white unemployment. It's not because black people are lazy. It has a structural history. There's a structural reality that produces that outcome. Think about the dual housing market. one of the interesting things about the Fair Labor, the Fair Housing Act of 1968 is that it wasn't implemented. There's a reason why residential segregation, this society is as segregated as it was in 1954, right? If not more so, particularly when it comes to schools, right? There's a reason why African-American wealth is what it is. White wealth is 13 times that of African-American wealth, right? There's a reason why African-American communities were devastated with the collapse of the housing market, because we had just really, most of our wealth was located in our homes, right? And even in that, we see the effects, the lingering effects of a dual housing market. But then we get the claims that black people aren't working hard enough, they're not saving, as if there's no history to this.
Right.
As if there's no context to this. And part of the reason why that's the case, whether it's coming out of the mouth of Rudy Giuliani or whether it's coming out of the mouth of a neighbor, right, is because there is this clinging illusion of innocence, right? There's this illusion of innocence, right, that is so necessary to protect our fellow citizens from looking the ugliness of who we are as a nation and who we've been as a nation squarely in the face.
You mentioned Giuliani. His response was basically that black people have to teach their kids to respect police officers, if it wasn't so sort of tragic and I think so widely held of a belief, it would be a hilarious thing to say. Particularly in light of what we saw in terms of these shootings over the past couple of weeks, but
Diamond Reynolds was saying, "Yes, sir. Yes, I mean, as respectful as you could be." You know, D.L. Hughley, the comedian who has a radio show, he made an interesting analogy. He says the basic logic of Giuliani's claim and those like him follows this, right? It effect blames black people for their murder by the police, right? And he made this kind of analogy. He said it's like saying that a woman was raped because of what she wore.
Right.
So Giuliani is saying at this moment, well, we need to teach them to be more respectful, as if that warrants lethal force, right? Or black on black crime. Right. I mean, which we know is a kind of red herring, because crime typically happens in neighborhoods where people live in close proximity with each other. So black on black crime is as meaningful a category as white on white crime. Right. So it has a history, right, in the context of law and order discourse as a way of kind of pigeonholing black communities in certain sorts of ways. So we know what that dog whistle is all about. Right. So it's hard. And let me say this, Sam, it's so exhausting. And I just want your listeners to hear this. It's so exhausting for black people in moments of grieving and mourning to have to convince white people of our suffering. It is one of the most annoying things in the world that I have to convince you, right, of the unequal treatment under the law when we see disparate impact, which suggests clearly, right, widespread discrimination and unequal and unbiased, and I mean, and widespread discrimination and bias, that I have to convince you in the moment in which we're grieving, right? So I said before that if the first thing comes to your mind when you saw Philando Castile bleeding out and dying was black on black crime or the criminal behavior of black people, then you don't give a damn about black life, and you're just trying to cover the fact that you don't give a damn about black life.
And it seems to me, I mean, there's a continuum insofar as, I mean, you obviously, as a professor, I don't know what kind of car you drive, but I imagine if you drive a car, it's probably a nice car. I mean, I wish I could go back or at least have maybe taken a survey, but I'm going to guess that you've been pulled over multiple times by the police in your life for driving that car. And I know that I could ask this question of any other professor who came on this program who was white, and the answer would be, no, I've never been pulled over. I mean, there was that one time the police officer warned me about a traffic jam that was up or something like that, but I'm convinced of it. I mean, am I right or wrong about
it? Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first got I'm a BMW guy, right? You know, I'm a Morehouse man. You see me in my nice suit, Sam, I'll admit it. I'm driving. I just got a 5 Series BMW. It was beautiful, and I drove, and I was driving to work. And lo and behold, the lights, I think this was like in 2004, 2005, and the lights hit, and I pull over. No, it was 2007. I pull over, and the guy says, "Nice car. Where are you going?" You know, but that's just, you know, that's just par for the course, right? I mean, you know the study around stop and frisk in New right. York. We know this. We make the claims around driving while black. We make the claims around, you know, I mean, we can just go on and on. And every time we make these claims, there are folks in America who justify this kind of policing, coming out of broken windows, coming out of a general philosophy of policing, by claiming that police are just trying to stop criminals. And so they're willing to throw, right, certain basic rights that define us as a society out of the window when it comes to certain people.
And I should say, even if the reason why, in the broadly speaking, the reason why in that police officer's mind he was stopping you was not like, I'm going to go harass a black guy. It was, this is part of what I do as policing. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. Like,
exactly.
The intent of the police to stop crime by stopping a guy who I would imagine 99 out of 100 days out of the year, you're dressed better than I am, driving a car, it doesn't matter if his intent was, we've had a rash of well-dressed people stealing BMWs around here. I mean, that is, I think, the thing that I think it's very hard for white people to understand is that in this, on some level, I think it's a continuum. I think it's a continuum you don't know, you know, at that point, we certainly have examples of people in that situation where your annoyance or maybe just the cop has had a tough day ends up leading into something horribly awry. I mean, it would be irrational not to have that in the back of your head anyways.
Yeah, we saw that with Eric Garner. This is the day. You got, just leave me alone. You know, he just had enough on that day, and now he's not breathing. I mean, but, you know, this is a broader culture. I mean, look, Pat McCrory and the governor of North Carolina just signed legislation to say that police cameras, that coverage, that footage is not available for public record. So there's something happening around policing and democracy in this country, at least in North Carolina. Or even those of us who were horrified by the murder of the Dallas police officers, but who are committed to a democratic society of due process. What does it mean that a robot carrying a bomb was deployed? Right. So not only was the guy, I mean, we knew the guy was guilty, but I mean, why not a stun grenade? What does it mean that on U.S. soil, that police chose to use a robot to deliver a bomb to blow up someone, to blow someone into pieces? What happened to the Fifth Amendment?
I totally agree with you on that. I have been shocked at the complete lack of examination of that by the media. I mean, I understand the idea. You have a sniper. The guy's involved in an active shooting. The sniper shoots that guy. But they clearly had him contained for 5 hours. If they have the ability to bring a bomb in there from a stun gun, some type of, I don't know, sleeping gas, whatever it is.
Exactly.
That to me was... It's shocking that there doesn't seem to be any question, but it's quite clear this guy was executed. He was not shot in the course of a battle. I understand they wanted to protect the police officers, but they proved they could deliver anything at that moment without it being a harm to police officers.
And I think we need to be clear, Sam, that this is not about empathy for the shooter.
No.
This is about our commitment to democracy. This is about our commitment to due process. This is where security... Right, we don't want security to undermine the fundamental basic principles, right, of a democratic society. So I want to make sure that those of those out there who are listening to us make these claims, that this isn't about sympathy for the sniper.
Absolutely
this is about
not.
Our commitment, right, to a fundamentally democratic society.
I mean, it may have been ultimately more merciful to blow the guy up rather than because he would have gone away for, I imagine, life. But at the very least, we need to have a trial, A and B. I mean, the other argument is if we thought this guy had planted explosive devices around the city, there's a very strong security argument that you want this guy strapped down on a gurney so that if he has any information to tell you, he can tell you to save other lives. I mean, it doesn't seem clear to me that we were satisfied at that time that, like, there were no other bombs anywhere else. But
Exactly.
All right, but leaving that aside, I want to get back to how we respond to this problem, and I want to tie in with what you've written in Time.com, which is my democratic problem with voting for Hillary Clinton. Now, at the end of Democracy in Black, and we talked about this, I think, in January. And at the end of the book, you had suggested that, well, a response, or perhaps the response, should be for African-American people and, I guess, people who were allied to not vote, at least in the presidential race.
To vote down ballot, right.
And so let's start, as we enter into both this discussion of, you know, how can we fix this problem? Like, what, you know, are there... You know, how big do the fixes have to be? How much are we willing to trade away? In other words, if we could have body cams on police officers that where the stuff was like automatically uploaded so that there was an ongoing video stream that we could all witness at any given time, is that worthwhile, or does that let the air out of the tires and prevent greater reform? And what would that greater reform be? And then let's talk about the political process as well.
Right. I think body cams are, of course, offer us a number of different a different kind of answer, but they also raise questions about privacy, right? Police being able to see things that they ought not to see, and the video footage capturing that. So we need to understand that body cams aren't the answer to the question of policing in this country. I think there needs to be a much broader set of considerations that go beyond common sense policing, right? That go beyond calls for community policing. That's not just simply about training. I think one of the things we need to think about is in some ways misdemeanor decriminalization. And here I'm following the lead of my colleague Naomi Murakawa, that there needs to be a radical reduction in the number of misdemeanor arrests in this country. Sam, you know, you could just breathe and you can break a law in the United States. You know, so, and we see that misdemeanor arrests keep increasing despite falls in violent and property crime in this country. Right? So I think we need to start talking about decriminalization in a very serious way. I mean, and that's going to hit at predatory policing, because we know misdemeanor arrest and the like is a source of revenue for municipalities in so many different ways. So we have to talk about that. And it also decreases the amount of encounter between police and citizens, right? And so that's one thing. I think we also need to begin to think about the elimination of fees for jail stays and indigent defense, right, and minor court processing fees, right, which is again part of this predatory thing. And then there's this thing that I keep that's in my head, and it has something to do with the stuff around bail, you know, that we need to eliminate the system of bail and pretrial detention for all but serious violent crime. And here I'm echoing my colleague Naomi Murakawa again. Sandra Bland would be alive today,
right,
if she didn't have to pay $500 cash. My colleague Imani Perry, right, was locked up for a speeding ticket and not paying her speeding tickets and the like, and it created a firestorm across the country. She had to pay cash, right, in order to be released. And that's why they locked her up. That's why she was handcuffed to a table. They weren't going to release her because she didn't have the cash in her wallet and they didn't take credit cards.
Of course, if she had the cash in her wallet, then they would probably hold her because what's she doing with that much cash in her wallet?
And, but you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So part of what we have to begin to think about, what's the context for a citizen police encounter, right? What is the system of what is the criminal justice system that in some ways is in some predatory, feeding off of black and brown and poor communities? Right? And this goes beyond training. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So we need to start having a serious discussion of what it means to think about policing in this country. And then that discussion has to be a subset of a broader discussion around safety. Right? And I think DeRay McKesson and Campaign Zero, they've been made a great point in this regard, right? That the issue of safety in our communities isn't reducible to policing. And I don't think we heard that. We didn't hear this level of conversation from the Sanders campaign, and we certainly didn't hear it from the Clinton campaign. So I think that's the beginning step, right? And it's going to be a hard conversation to have.
Right, as we sort of completely reimagine what the point of police have become, at the very least, and perhaps exactly. have always been in these communities and all of our communities, broadly speaking. All right, so let's move to what you've written in Time.com, because you know that I spend a lot of time arguing against this argument. You basically outline your problem with voting for Hillary Clinton. Would you, let me just start with this, because you wrote, something similar in your book, not specific, I think, to Hillary per se at the time, but just broadly mm-hmm. speaking. So this is not necessarily because it's not Bernie situation.
Right. No, it's not that. You know, Bernie Sanders, as I said in the piece, was just one bloom of this broader Democratic awakening that's happening in the country. And so to reduce this Democratic awakening to Bernie Sanders is a standard kind of practice to try to render American citizens as cattle chewing cud, that we just simply to be herded, that we just follow people.
Okay, right? So it's not, this is
and
not a Bernie, in other words, this is not a Bernie or bust argument.
In fact, Sam, what I'm trying to do is give the Bernie or bust people a strategy of how to approach this, because this is somewhat, the piece in Time is somewhat different from the blank out campaign that I call for in Democracy in Black. In Democracy in Black, I didn't know. I anticipated it was going to be Hillary Clinton. I didn't anticipate Donald Trump. I was thinking it was going to be Jeb Bush. How wrong was I when I was writing the book? And part of what I was saying is that, you know, the Democratic Party, which has been captured by corporate interest, as you know, right, every 2-4 years will come into our communities, right, and really not, you know, engage in a kind of rhetorical flourish, but really the candidates have little to no intention of delivering on policy. And so political scientists have described black communities as a kind of captured electorate, right? That we have nowhere to go. The Republican Party has no interest outside of kind of, you know, pulling about a certain percentage of black voters to its tent, but they have no interest in delivering policy, and the Democratic Party, we have nowhere else to go, so they don't have to deliver. They just got to get us out to vote. And all of this is happening while our communities are just simply devastated. So I said, why don't we just blank out? If you don't present a platform that speaks to the condition of black communities, then we're going to turn out in massive numbers as we did in 2008 and 2012, but we're going to vote down ballot. That was the argument in Democracy in Black. This argument is different. What I'm arguing here is that black voters can be conceived, and I have an op-ed piece coming out with the political scientist Frederick Harris out of Columbia where we make this argument more explicit. I'm not going to vote for Clinton, and I can make that decision because I live in New Jersey.
Right. Right.
I can make that decision, but if I was in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Florida, right, or one of the swing states, the contested states, the battleground states, right? I'm a pivotal voter. I want us to turn out in massive numbers. I want us to turn out in massive numbers in those states. And I'm saying if you vote for Clinton because you don't want Trump, do that. In fact, we need to do that. Right? But there are also the pressure voters, right? And I'm not a pressure voter in some ways. I may be in Jersey, but there's some pressure voters. Those are folks like in Texas and Mississippi. Right. Folks in decidedly red states where if they vote for Clinton, that's basically throwing. It's not going to matter.
Right.
It's not going to matter at all. if you vote for, if you're, if my mother and father went to the voting booth in Moss Point, Mississippi, and voted for Clinton in Mississippi, it's not going to affect the outcome at all, because we know who's going to win that state, right? So, but we can begin to have an impact, right? We can begin to have an impact by simply engaging in voting for a third party candidate or leaving the ballot blank, and that could have an impact on, you know, delegates to the 2020 convention, you know, in terms of representation, given that if you have lower voter totals for the party standard bearer in that state, it'll have an impact moving forward, right? So part of what I'm trying to do in that piece, Sam, is register two things, and underlying both is one basic thing, right? Donald Trump is he's an exaggerated indication of the rot at the heart of the country. What's really the problem is that the way we're living our lives is no longer sustainable. And the question we have to ask ourselves of Hillary Clinton is that, is she going to change anything? Or is this business as usual? We can't have business as usual. So part of the response of the piece is this, twofold. One, we got to keep Trump from being elected. And two, we got to register that we're totally dissatisfied with the corporate takeover of the Democratic Party. That we find business as usual unacceptable. How do we do that in an election cycle where we have a figure like Donald Trump, right? So those are the first two. That's much motivating. And then there's this last point, and thank you so much for giving me the time to explain it. This last point is this. It is absolutely unacceptable to me that some folks are putting so much burden on black and brown people to keep Trump from office, to keep Trump out of the presidency, when in fact it seems to me that we need to be talking to all of the white folks who are supporting him and understanding what the hell that means. Because it seems to me that Hillary Clinton is presuming that black and brown people are so fearful of Trump that we're going to turn out in massive numbers and deliver the presidency to her, while she panders to the median voter, right? Try to appeal to that white working class voter, right? And she has no intention of actually putting forward concrete policies that will deliver us from the misery that will address the misery in of our communities right now. Somebody needs to be talking about all of these white folks who are supporting Trump.
Well,
and what that means.
I mean,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, and I listen, I'm no I'm not a particular fan of Hillary Clinton's. I've been a longtime supporter of Bernie Sanders. I think to some degree that we're seeing some proposals, certainly more than I think that Clinton was hoping to make on day one, that address some of the issues you're talking about. I'm not even sure that Bernie Sanders necessarily fully addressed these things. I mean, I think, like, look, you know, the reality is that Democratic candidates always lose the white vote, whether it's Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, or Barack Obama versus McCain, or Bill
John
Clinton.
Kerry.
On and on. The Democrats lose the white vote. As basically since 1965, and I think to a large extent, you know, we know the answer of why all those people are voting for Donald Trump.
Exactly.
I mean, a big part of it is because they don't like black people and non-white people. I mean, that's it. It may not be explicit.
That's a big part of it.
It's not. It's not all of it.
Not all of it.
But it's. There's probably a 15% a group of people in there who feel, I don't know, maybe by some of his non-nationalistic racist rhetoric. But, I mean, I think, you know, from the perspective of a swing state vote, of preventing Donald Trump, and frankly, you know, I thought Bernie Sanders in his speech yesterday when he was up there with Clinton did a fine job of reminding people that Trump may be an extraordinary buffoon and explicit with his racism, but at the end of the day, he's basically what the Republican Party is.
Right.
He's not extraordinarily distinct from the Republican Party. You know, Jeb Bush, you have a piece, you write in here, nothing said when Republicans reject Trump on ideological grounds, like Jeb Bush, argue that Trump isn't a true conservative. Well, I can tell you that as a pundit, whether I'm sitting at the TV or at a table on TV, I say, that's bullshit. He doesn't. He's not rejecting Donald Trump because he's not a true conservative. Jeb Bush doesn't. There's no true conservative. That's all. You know, when they talk about like the exchange with him and Nicole Wallace on, you know, it was about gun control and abortion. Excuse me. Jeb Bush doesn't care about gun control or abortion either. He just those are just that's just bait for their suckers to allow them to come in and continue on with certain economic policies that hurt everybody. And so, you know,
economic policies that the Democratic Party make a little bit more
slightly
not as harsh. But, you know, this is the Thomas Frank's point.
Right.
You know, I mean, so Jeb Bush's donors will say, I'm not supporting the Republican Party. They'll run over to Hillary Clinton because, you know, is there a difference that makes a difference between the two?
But do you accept the idea? And I understand in the context of a state that is, you know, clearly going to go blue, or a context of a state that's clearly going to go red, where again, your vote, you know, down ballot, of course, it's extremely important.
Exactly.
In terms of the top of the ticket, you have the strategy for how you vote changes because your vote is not as crucial. You can perhaps make it possible for the Green Party to get on the ticket the next time or whatever it is. But do you, beyond that, do you accept the notion that there's going to be more opportunity to push a Hillary Clinton in more positive directions than there would be a Donald Trump or Jeb Bush for that matter?
Well, I mean, yes. On its face, I mean, you have to be honest. I mean, you know, that is to say that Donald Trump would have no incentive to listen,
right,
to you know, to folks outside clamoring for more progressive policies. Hillary Clinton would, but what did we just experience over the last 8 years, though, Sam? We experienced a White House. I mean, I remember in the first term, his press secretary, you know, basically dismissing the left, right, as a bunch of politically naive folk,
right,
as we were trying to push the Obama administration. I've witnessed up close the way in which, on the one hand, he's asking us to push him, but on the other hand, they were policing dissent, right, and literally rendering critical voices illegitimate, right, in so many different ways over the course of the last 8 years. Right, and remember the energies that President Obama came in. That was WTO energy. That was the critique of the Iraq War energy. Right, and then that energy got destabilized and disorganized and dispersed, and then we had Occupy, and that Occupy energy is along with the Black Lives Matter energy, right, is really I think what was driving the Bernie Sanders campaign in interesting sorts of ways. So Hillary Clinton, that platform, that Democratic platform, could be as progressive as it could possibly be. She's going to get in the office and she's going to govern exactly how she has governed over the course of her political career. There's no evidence whether the platform says free college tuition, which we have to drill down into, whether the platform offers $15, supports $15 minimum wage, livable wage, right? She's going to govern precisely like she has governed up to this point. There's nothing in Hillary Clinton's past or present which suggests that she's going to change business as usual, that she's going to change the status quo. Our only and most compelling reason to vote for her is because we don't want this idiot, Donald Trump, to be the president of the United States. That's the only compelling reason.
I would agree. Well, I would agree with that's the most compelling reason. I do
think. You would
think,
say the only compelling.
Well, okay, I mean, look, I'm trying to look at this optimistically because there's two factors that I think need to be taken into consideration. One, Obama at this stage in his election was not being forced to come out with the level of specificity that Clinton has. Like, I think that when Clinton gets into office, it is not going to be with the same honeymoon from the left that Obama had. I mean, I remember in 2009, in the summer of 2009, saying, like, there's a real problem here with this bankruptcy cram down and having people, call me a emo prog or whatever. We're not going to hear the words emo prog. We're not going to hear that in the context of Clinton, I don't think. I think we're going to have a much more activated left who is going to be pushing her on a consistent basis. And in terms of like her prior governing, I don't know that there's a huge amount of evidence on where she's been, frankly, you know, in an executive position in the back, one way or another. I certainly know where her, we look at her campaign and I see some of the personnel in the past that she had. It doesn't make me very excited, although a guy like Podesta is better than a guy like Rahm Emanuel, for that matter. But I will also say, to the extent that we do know some broader characteristics, at least of the Clinton machine, there is a certain amount of opportunism that goes along with their quite cozy relationship with like Reubenites. And the terrain is different. Like, there is much more room. There is much more power. And, you know, a lot of it depends on, like, you know, what organization come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign and how people maintain their activism. But I just think that that it's, you know, we've witnessed over the course of this campaign that she can be moved. You know, like you say, the free college thing, now we're at $125,000 per person in each, you know, as a free college. And that's very different in my mind than making people of living in poverty or people of lower income having to work their way through college. Whereas, you know, Donald Trump's kid, I just assume send him to college for free because he's going free anyways, as far as he's concerned.
So Sam, we're not that far apart. So I mean, I find it very. I think what you're saying is very interesting, right? Because I think you're absolutely right. She's not going to have the honeymoon that Barack Obama had. And so the question is, how are we going to be mobilized and organized?
Right.
How are we going to signal to the Clinton administration if she's elected, right? That we're going to hold her administration to the fire, right? And part of that has to do with the way in which we participate in this election season, right? I think we need to shift the balance. Right. We need to shift the balance of focus. Right. In so many ways, the Republican assault on big government has made all of the innovation downstream anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We've ceded state houses and state legislators. We haven't paid enough attention. I'm talking about progressives in this regard.
Yep.
Progressives to local county seats. And what's happening in mayoral seats where all the innovation is happening anyway. So part of what I'm trying to suggest here is that if we focus our attention down ballot, where stuff is still as corrupt. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Democrats down ballot or progressives down ballot are any better than the folks on the ticket, but I'm just saying we need to do what we need to do in order to shift the balance, to shift the center of gravity of our political concern, right? If we start doing that and she gets in office, then we're mobilized to bring pressure to bear.
Yep.
Then we're mobilized to bring pressure to bear. I think it's important for the Clinton folk to know, particularly among black folk, and this is particularly important for the black political class to see, right? Although I'm so on the margins in this regard, because to my mind there's no viable distinction to be made between the black political class and the Democratic establishment today. They're one and the same. But I think it's important for these folk to know that this is a new game in town. These folk aren't just going to be herded to the polls like cattle. Right. You have some in red states that are not voting for Democrats at all, or they're not voting for the Democratic presidential nominee at all. Right. And then you have the folks in the swing states who are mobilized, turning out in massive numbers. And not only are they voting for Hillary Clinton, they're voting down ballot. Right. And then you have some in the blue states who are voting for her, some who aren't. Right. And part of this is to signal to the Clinton administration that when you get in office, right, this is a mobilized constituency across the board. Because, Sam, I'm saying this is what they do to us, man. They make us believe that our only choices are the choices right in front of us. And the result is a very anemic conception of democracy, a very anemic idea of our power as people in democracies. We have to be bold. We have to be, because the stakes are too high, and the stakes aren't just simply Trump.
I would agree with that, and I would amend it insofar as saying okay. It may be that we have limited choices in terms of the presidency, but that's not the limit of our options in terms of bringing political power to bear. And so that really, as important as strategically voting is, it's far more important. You know, even as important it is to send a signal to a Clinton administration, like, look, here, there's a percentage of these people are voting for Green. That has far less salience, it seems to me, than activism that takes place following the election and continues through the election. I mean, past the election and into the legislating, because they can look at the numbers, and there's a whole myriad of different sort of reasons why you could say, well, it was raining in Austin, and that's why people, you know. But what's more important is that people, continue to organize and. You know, this is one of the things I thought that Bernie Sanders did and was completely misunderstood about. I think from day one, and that may have changed somewhere around day, I don't know, 125. But on day one, Bernie Sanders entered this race to create a movement and to push a message. And it may have changed between, you know, day 125 and day 250. But at the end, it was clear that what he was doing was running parallel to the presidential campaign, not solely in that lane. Like, he is pushing through this, and I'm convinced that everything he's been doing in the past 6 weeks to 3 months, and even beyond, before that, is a function of what he intends to do 3 to 6 months after the election, 12 months, 18 months after the election, and so on. And I think that's the way that we need to think, too. I don't know, maybe someday I'll have a chance to ask him that question, but we'll see.
Well, you know, maybe 3 months or 6 months after the election, you and I may need to sit down and have a nice Irish whiskey.
Looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to that.
Where we are. But I think, this is precisely the kind of conversation we need to be having. We don't need folk to be beating the drums to force everyone in line. We have an opportunity. This is a battle over the soul, not only of the Democratic Party, but over the soul of the nation. And we need to take it as seriously as such. And I want to suggest to you, because I think you're right, what I'm commending and what you're describing as more important, I think they're actually continuous. That the work that we need to do post-election, right, well, the ground must be tilled, right, during the election. It's not enough for us to have been excited about the Sanders campaign, to hear the rhetoric of a political revolution. We need to make it known. We need a strategy in the streets. As I said in Democracy in Black, when we talked about this in January, I said in order to change this thing, we need a revolution of value. And that revolution of value will involve a strategy in the streets and a strategy at the ballot box. We got to change the game.
Professor Eddie Gloud, Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, author of Democracy in Black. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to
you. Thanks, Doc.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you.
Rebecca. Brian Eno, ladies and gentlemen. Brian Eno. That was Professor Eddie Gloud. Always a great guest and a real treat. Folks, this show exists because of your membership. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen, to support your favorite or maybe your second favorite, even maybe your third favorite podcast.
Wow, you're really stretching it there.
I'm just saying. If you have three favorite podcasts, you should support all three. But forget about those other two. Are they really your favorite? I don't think so.
There you go. Now you sound less nebbishy.
Let's be honest. I want to get cucky around here.
I thought it was very cuck.
Very cuck of me. Folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Oh, that was Brian Ferry, not Brian Eno, someone's telling me.
Roxy Music.
Yeah, and Roxy Music is Brian Eno. Of Brian Ferry. Now I've lost my place. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get the 10% off your fair trade coffee. Get the Majority Report blend. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Don't want to buy stuff from Amazon? Buy it from Jet.com. People love Jet at MajorityReportKickback.com. You got to forgive me, folks. I have like a long list of what's the word I'm looking for? Malaises. People keep saying Brian Ferry, not Brian Eno.
I think we can move past it.
But I do feel like my throat might be closing up.
Well, that's a whole other kettle of fish there.
We'll talk more about that on Roxy Music with Brian Ferry, not Brian Eno. Eno was more of a producer. Okay, so fair enough.
Jesus Christ.
That really just sent
now
me
we got
down
like
wrong.
Another sounds like another math thing to me. It's getting disturbing.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head to the fun half, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You will hear the litany of physical malaises I have right after this.